The following program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The North Carolina Reading Service brings you Indie Week. I'm John Federson, and reading this issue, dated September 21 of 2022. And our studios are fairly empty today. Our musical ensemble, who are known as the Carnivore Collective, has been performing our theme very well when they haven't been marauding up and down our corridors, munching on the other volunteers. So I will continue reading Indie Week as long as they don't sniff me out in my little corner studio. So here I go. As I often do, I'll alternate between articles in the print edition and the Indie Week online at indieweek.com, which has a couple of articles which are a little more recent. This one by Chad Knuth, about the city of Durham and the Durham Housing Authority. They receive a $40 million grant. The grant comes as part of $200 million in funds awarded by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and will be aimed at augmenting Forever Home Durham, which is an ongoing partner-centric program creating affordable opportunities for renters and homeowners through new construction, property repairs, and essential housing services. Last week, Congressman David Price announced in a press release that the City of Durham and the Housing Authority are the recipients of a $40 million Choice Neighborhoods Implementation Grant. And that comes as part of $200 million in funds awarded by HUD and will be aimed at the aforementioned Forever Home Durham. DHA has plans to focus the allocated $40 million in funding in part toward the revitalization of Durham's existing 519 East Main Street apartments, along with the development of multiple other DHA, city, and county-owned properties in the downtown, central, and southeast central Durham communities, according to a press release announcing that grant. The development plan incorporates ground floor retail, a new community park, and other green spaces, as well as a new community center, new roads, and a public safety initiatives to reduce crime and violence. While the new funding is exciting, Haiti residents and others are wary of the city's past efforts when tasked with urban renewal. The Southeast Central Durham community, one of the areas at the focus of this $40 million CNI grant, is known to many in the surrounding area more commonly as Haiti, an important historically black community with roots dating as early as the late 19th century. Haiti, historically the home to a thriving community of black homeowners and business owners, was decimated in 1970 by the completion of the first leg of North Carolina Highway 147, the Durham Freeway. The construction resulted in the destruction of a portion of the Haiti neighborhood and effectively cut the neighborhood off from what is now a prosperous metropolitan area. A variety of failed promises and attempts at urban renewal followed over the ensuing decades. For many living in the Haiti community today, the allocation of the CNI grant might appear as another attempt by the city and DHA to fix a sordid history with a once thriving community. Congressman Price said, "We cannot fully comprehend the nation's affordable housing crisis without looking to our past, particularly regarding federal policies designed to intentionally marginalize communities of color. Programs like the Choice Neighborhood Initiative provide targeted funding for these historically underinvested areas. And the initiative will aim to rectify this harmful legacy and achieve housing justice." Anthony Scott, CEO of the Durham Housing Authority, echoed these sentiments, saying, "The reality on the ground is that there are two downtowns in Durham. The newer part is disproportionately wealthy, white, and growing, while the edges are lower-income communities of color that are shrinking in the gentrification pressure. The Choice Neighborhood Implementation Grant will help us bring these two together, further bridging the gap and restoring Durham's community forever. But members of the Haiti community are wary nonetheless. As the Indy previously reported, Henry McCoy, an NC Central University professor who spearheaded Haiti Reborn, warns that the DHA's approach to redeveloping Haiti will only reinforce the gentrification already taking place throughout the district. And with good reason, as Haiti in particular has been in the sights of several out-of-state developers over the years. Nearly a decade ago, in 2006, a prominent shopping center in the Haiti community was sold to Andrew Rothschild, a Manhattan physician turned private developer. Rothschild's purchase of the shopping center was reported in the real estate section of the New York Times, stating that Rothschild had plans to build, quote, a $130 million, six-block, multi-story district that will reconnect underneath the freeway the streets between downtown and Haiti. Like many such plans, nothing ever came to fruition. Continuing the trend, in recent months, Sterling Bay, a Chicago-based development firm, announced in June a joint venture with another Chicago firm and a New York developer to purchase a swath of declining commercial space within the Haiti community. Again, no further planning has yet to come from the deal. While it clearly won't turn back history, the $40 million grant is undoubtedly a win for the city of Durham. With it, there is still some hope that the city and DHA can begin to make amends and revitalize a community that has long been severed by a freeway. Next, from the Indy online, from Tomasi McDonald. More green space, less crime, is the title. On a sunny mid-afternoon this week, Hillside Park's heavy tree canopy offered a welcome respite from the day's rising temperatures. Largely owing to gentrification and a housing inventory shortage, the traditionally black community is becoming increasingly diversified. An older white woman walked her two small dogs around a sidewalk that encircles the park's baseball field. Meanwhile, a shirtless black man napping in the outfield let loose with a loud yawn. Three black teens puffed on a blunt underneath the park's picnic shelter. It's all good in the neighborhood at the moment, but Hillside Park, which sits in the southern shadow of Durham's downtown district, has been the scene of at least two violent fatal crimes in recent years. In late 2019, of May of 2019, police charged 18-year-old Antonio Standback with murder following the shooting death of Darren Dixon, a 22-year-old man who was found dead in the gazebo at the park on South Roxborough Street. The year before, police charged Michael Person, 55, with the stabbing death of Alicia Elder, 50, at the park. Elder and Dixon were the sole victims of fatal, violent crimes at that park since 2010. That's two fatalities too many, but it's also revealing. Last month, a team of scholars found that urban green spaces like Hillside Park were linked to a lower crime risk in hundreds of major cities across the United States, including Charlotte, Raleigh, and Durham. Urban green spaces are, quote, loosely defined as any type of plant-covered environment, public or private, located within a city, according to the authors of the study. The 12-page study was authored by a team of researchers that include L. R. Larson, an associate professor in the Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Management at North Carolina State University. Larson says in an email he wrote to Indy this week, "We found these results to be very compelling. It's pretty remarkable that while controlling for many other factors that have been linked to crime in previous studies, urban green space displays such a strong and consistent inverse relationship with both violent and property crime risk in nearly 300 cities across the United States." The scholars made their findings public After collecting data from more than 62,000 census blocks in cities across the nation with populations of over 100,000 and the respective cities' overall crime rates. The researchers also considered median household income along with diversity and disadvantage indexes. Larson says diversity index directly accounted for race and was based on the proportion of the population in each of the 14 racial and ethnic groups recorded by the U.S. Census Bureau. He explains in the email, higher diversity scores meant a great variety of races were present in an area. The disadvantage index takes into account four variables: percentage of residents and families within a census block or neighborhood who are unemployed, living below the poverty level, have less than a high school education, or are in homes where women are the head of the household with children under the age of 18. Larson writes, we did not explore links between green space, diversity, and social disadvantage in this study. But other research has shown that communities of color and low-income communities typically contain lower quality parks and reduce access to green space. Still, the researchers concluded that green spaces lower crime risks because, in an overwhelming majority of neighborhoods in close proximity to ecosystems, residents reported an improved overall quality of life, increased physical activity, improved mental health, and a greater sense of community. On the other side of the coin, they also suggest that while urban green spaces can deter crime, the areas can also generate criminal activity by limiting, quote, visibility and reducing sight lines that could provide cover for criminals and illicit behavior in public spaces. Moreover, the study suggests that poorly maintained green spaces that are riddled with overgrown vegetation and litter can communicate a lack of oversight and attract criminal activities. Maybe the dearth of green space and tree coverings can help to explain why the highly racially segregated McDougal Terrace public housing complex is consistently ranked as the most violence-prone community in the Bull City. A small park on Sema Avenue that's across from the apartment complex is dotted with a scattering of trees, along with a picnic shelter and brightly colored playground equipment. But, except for a ring of trees that encircles the complex, there is no tree covering to offer shade from an unrelenting sun for folks sitting outside on their porches. The sun's heat bounces off concrete, brick, and asphalt surfaces and settles into the McDougal residents' reality like an unwelcome guest. A terrace resident who lives across the street from the park spoke with Indy this week. She was not optimistic about the study's finding and doubted whether more green space in the community could deter crime. The woman, who declined to give her name, said, I don't think nothing's going to change unless God himself comes out here. It's a good idea, though. We need more lights. They come and bust the lights out, she added, about lawbreakers in the neighborhood. The research, although compelling, is not surprising. Durham's elected leaders, activists, and scholars in recent years have pointed to the benefits of more verdant green spaces throughout the city, particularly trees. Trees, they say, are good for cities and their residents. They reduce air pollution, mitigate stormwater runoff, cool homes naturally, and generally improve the health of the ecosystem. Studies have found that trees reduce stress and brain fatigue and have been linked to lower levels of obesity and higher property values. Indeed, the absence of tree canopies in low-income communities lead to higher temperatures that fuel high utility costs and a higher incidence of health-related issues, as Indy has previously reported. The study published last month also offers a series of caveats. For starters, the researchers find, quote, the strongest positive predictor of violent crime within block groups was social disadvantage. Moreover, although urban green spaces are linked to near across-the-board decrease in crime risks, The study determines that is not the case in Chicago, Detroit, and Newark. The authors state, in these three cities, greater urban green space was related to increased violent crime risk within neighborhoods. And while Detroit had the highest mean violent crime risk and lowest median income of all cities, Chicago and Newark did not rank as extreme on the median income spectrum. Larson says the research team was more surprised that green space had such a strong and consistent influence on crime risk reduction in every other city in the country. Larson says in the email, we aren't sure why that relationship didn't hold in those three cities, but all three are notorious for their high crime rates that seem to be impervious to many interventions. It's quite likely that other social and environmental factors that we didn't account for in our analysis might have a disproportionately larger influence in those cities. The researchers suggest that the three cities are outliers owing to other social, economic, and cultural factors not accounted for in their study, including neighborhood disinvestment and abandonment, along with suffering from greater amounts of vacant land that communicate a lack of care while offering settings for criminal activity. The researchers also surmise that the three cities' high degree of racial segregation might also lead to concentrations of violent crime. Larson says segregation often fuels social disadvantage, which is typically linked to crime. The study, which relied on spatial views of urban communities across the United States, also considers the impact of climate, noting that, quote, further research is needed on the role climate may play in the crime and green space dynamic beyond mean temperatures, considering especially the increased number of extreme heat events predicted in the future. So, how big of a role will climate change play in future criminal activity? Larson says, the short answer is we don't know. Some studies suggest that climate change will lead to increased heat waves and more stress on resources and people that fuel higher levels of crime, warfare, and other types of violence. For example, crime rates are always higher in the summer months. By helping to mitigate temperature, i.e., urban heat islands, and the effects of climate change in cities, green space might provide additional crime-reducing benefits under these scenarios. Larson adds, quote, some of our research also seems to indicate that by reducing temperatures and fostering more conducive spaces for outdoor activities during really hot weather, green spaces might create environments that are actually more conducive for potential criminals who would be less mobile and active under extreme heat conditions. This study concludes by suggesting that crime in America's urban green spaces, particularly public parks, could be mitigated by applying the principles of law prevention through the elements of environmental design. Law prevention. The study authors state, our work does not support the idea that vegetation in general is a cause of crime, though such aspects as concealment or impaired visibility might present unique challenges. They add later that the integration of urban green space planning in urban crime prevention strategies offers many potential advantages. In addition to a more positive and less controversial approach than more aggressive law enforcement models, the researchers say crime prevention strategies that utilize urban green spaces are preferable attempts to curb crime instead of increasing the number of arrests for low-level offenses. The study authors state, proactive urban green space-based approaches may be even more important following the COVID pandemic, which has produced unprecedented challenges to mental health and social stability on a global scale. And Larson says, in fact, in our analysis, we found that green space was a stronger correlate of reduced crime risk than per capita police force in a city. Now I'll move to an op-ed column, letter from or an article by Frank Hyman, who is a Durham resident and authored the first living wage ordinance in North Carolina. This fall, Don't Go Green is the title. The North Carolina ballot in November will include Green Party candidates for U.S. Senate and the North Carolina Senate. If you dread the thought of Republicans taking either of those seats, I encourage you to forego casting your ballots for these Green candidates. Given that statement, you may be surprised to know I've felt an affinity for Green parties since their early 80s origin in Germany. As a former organic farmer, I'm pro-environment. As someone who's always made a living with my hands, I'm pro-worker and pro-union. As someone whose first political role at 18 was helping a candidate against the original Dixiecrat, Strom Thurmond, I've always supported marginalized people. But when Green Party candidate Ralph Nader pulled almost 3% of the vote in 2000 and tipped the scales in favor of Republican George W. Bush, none of those causes were helped. And in 2016, if voters in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan had voted for Hillary Clinton instead of the Green Party's Jill Stein, Trump would not have become president. How can the elections of Bush or Trump and the Supreme Court judges they've appointed be seen as a worthwhile trade-off for an opportunity to make a statement by voting Green at the state and national levels? On two occasions, activists have tried to start a Green Party chapter in my hometown of Durham. Each time I encourage them to put their worthwhile efforts into running candidates in nonpartisan races like city council, school board, and even conservation district. In those local races, any citizen can get on the ballot. A local Green Party can build its base and reputation from the ground up, can build a bench of skilled candidates and campaign workers over time, all without spending vast resources in getting ballot access for the state and national races. Races that can cause U.S. Senate candidate Sherry Beasley to lose a close election, for example. The response to my advice to these local Greens was always the same. It's only at the state and national levels that we can make real change. Yes, on some issues that's true. But how good is your argument when the real change that your efforts bring is to help Republicans win elections? And next from Chapel Hill, an article by Joe Killian, which was originally published in NC Policy Watch, Speaking Truth to Power. Faculty members at UNC Chapel Hill have often spoken their minds, but in some cases they have done so at their own peril. Political appointees on the Board of Governors have targeted academic centers whose work they oppose. They have allegedly meddled in faculty hiring decisions for political reasons, and they have exacted reprisals against faculty members who speak publicly on political controversies of the day. This month, the UNC Chapel Hill Faculty Council passed a resolution affirming the right of faculty members to speak freely and the university's duty to protect their speech. Mimi Chapman, a professor in the School of Social Work, said during the meeting, "Members should be encouraged to provide thought leadership, to be public scholars when their work gives them meaningful insight. This is what faculty at a great research university does. They weigh in. They share their knowledge and experience. We shouldn't be intimidated into hiding our light under the proverbial bushel." This resolution comes after the Chapel Hill Board of Trustees adopted both the Chicago Principles and the Calvin Committee report on the university's role in political and social action in late July. The Chicago Principles, crafted at the University of Chicago, affirm free expression as essential to university culture. Dozens of colleges, universities, and student and faculty groups have adopted them, including the Chapel Hill Faculty Council in 2018. But the principles are not without controversy. political conservatives, many who believe right-wing speech and ideology are suppressed in academia, support the principles. Some educators believe they preserve free, open, and rigorous debate on campuses, yet others say they fail to address some of the thorniest issues about free expression on campus and can be used to justify ignoring or curtailing student activism. Far more controversial is the Calvin Report, a product of the tumultuous political environment on campuses in the late 1960s. Few colleges or universities have adopted the conclusions of the report. Its critics at UNC System School say it's easy to see why. The report emphasizes that a university should stay neutral on controversial political issues. In adopting the Calvin Report, the Board of Trustees says it, quote, recognizes that the neutrality of the university on social and political issues arises out of respect for free inquiry and the obligation to cherish a diversity of viewpoints. The report, quote, further acknowledges a heavy presumption against the university taking collective action or expressing opinions on the political and social issues of the day. The trustees wrote in their resolution of support. Had the UNC Board of Trustees resolution been in place in 2018 when students toppled the Silent Sam Confederate Monument and some system leaders insisted on re-erecting it, university leaders could have felt constrained from publicly commenting on several aspects of that controversy, on the statue's meaning to black students and faculty, on the propriety of having such a monument on campus, on the contentious and ultimately scrapped deal the UNC system struck with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Now that the trustees adopted both principles in the report, it's unclear what university leaders and faculty members can say about current controversies, such as the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade. As Policy Watch reported in July, many people at UNC Chapel Hill felt frustrated by the university's silence about the end of the constitutional right to abortion, even as other major colleges and universities issued statements. In the absence of an official statement from UNC, Chapel Hill's Gillings School of Global Public Health released its own about the ruling's impacts on the day it was announced. Chapman, as head of the faculty, issued her own statement. She later said she had a dream. She had been fired for doing so. I'm not prone to anxiety dreams, she said. In her statement about Roe v. Wade reversal, Chapman was careful to say she was speaking only as an individual, not a representative of the university. That sort of disclaimer may be increasingly necessary, a legal expert told the faculty council, as professors and instructors struggle to preserve their ability to speak as subject experts without being seen as speaking for the university itself. In June, after the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, voted to condemn the UNC system for political interference, Chapman held a series of listening sessions with faculty members. What she heard from more than 50 faculty members tended to back up the AAUP's concerns that the political environment within the UNC system threatened academic freedom, chilled speech, and perpetuated systemic racism. Chapman said, through this process, I was alerted that faculty were getting, at best, mixed messages about their ability to speak out on their research and scholarship as pertains to issues of the day. Among the stories Chapman shared while preserving faculty anonymity were the following. A person was recruited to the university but has since found the curriculum they were brought in to teach has been, quote, put on ice to avoid political controversy. Another person's website was taken down without discussion or consultation after someone from outside the campus complained to a state legislator. A junior faculty member, excited about a book they have coming out, now worries it will anger some people, including some quarters of the power structure. They wonder what that might mean for tenure, promotion, and even their personal safety. Chapman said there is confusion about what constitutes political activity, which may be curtailed when using university time or resources, or resources versus speaking about issues that have become politicized. These are very different things. Anything can become politicized. That doesn't mean if I have expertise or relevant practice and experience in an area, I shouldn't speak about that. Michael Gerhardt, a professor at the UNC School of Law and a nationally recognized constitutional law scholar, spoke to faculty at last week's meeting about the tension between freedom of speech and the university's concerns over who represents the institution. Gerhardt understands that tension well. In 1998, he testified in then-President Bill Clinton's impeachment proceedings. He was called to do so again in 2019 during the proceedings against then-President Trump. "I cannot tell you," he said, "how much hate mail I got after I testified in 2019, enough to warrant police protection." The university helped him navigate the difficulty with some alumni who called for him to be fired, Gerhardt said, but he didn't initially feel much public support from the university. Nonetheless, he said he knew he was protected by the U.S. Constitution. As private citizens, faculty members have a First Amendment right to speak on politically controversial issues of the day, Gerhardt said. As government employees, it's trickier. It's constitutional, for example, for an entity that provides funding to a professor or department to place conditions on that money that could silence the recipients on controversial issues. Gerhardt said it's part of a professor's job to both educate in the classroom and help educate the public, such as through media interviews and court testimony, but to protect themselves from challenges about whether they should speak on a subject. Faculty members should make it clear they aren't spokespeople for their institutions, even if it's obvious they're speaking to an issue firmly within their area of expertise. Gerhardt said, "These days, it's really hard to find a subject that won't irritate somebody." Professor Eric Muller, a colleague of Gerhardt's in the law school, said it seems illogical for faculty members to have to make that distinction when speaking as subject matter experts. Mueller said, "It seems to me that if I post a restaurant review, make a political donation, or speak on behalf of a candidate, that's got to be me as Eric and not as a law professor. But if asked to explain something about abortion law, for example," Mueller said, "it seems odd to have to make the distinction. It's not that I'm speaking on behalf of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm just doing my job. And so it seems to me it would be an odd thing for me to have the affirmative obligation, when I'm doing my job, to say I'm not speaking on behalf of or representing the institution. I don't do that in the classroom. I don't get up and say, 'I want everybody to know that this is just us. I'm not speaking to you about Roe v. Wade on behalf of the university. I don't do that in my research.'" The resolution ultimately adopted by the faculty council did reflect Gerhardt's distinction about professors speaking for themselves versus the institution. But the council also emphasized that the university must defend its faculty members' rights to do this essential part of their jobs. Quote, "Public expression on matters of local, regional, national, and international importance is a core component of the jobs of many members of the faculty and must not be suppressed. Faculty members should be entitled to indicate their university affiliation in all expression related to their research, teaching, and service, so long as they do not indicate that they speak for the university as an institution. The university and its leaders must actively and publicly advocate for and defend the rights of faculty members to speak and write on all matters within the ambit of research, teaching, and service." Gerhardt said part of the faculty's and the university's mission is speaking truth to power. "Sometimes even the power doesn't like to hear it, but I think that's partly why we're here. Otherwise, we will not be able to advance knowledge, critical thinking, or improve the world in any shape or form." Next, Lynn Bonner offers Machine Misinformation. The northwestern North Carolina county on the Virginia border, Surrey County, is probably best known as the home of Mount Airy, the birthplace of Andy Griffith. This year, Surrey County has been a stop on the circuit for prominent election deniers who falsely maintain that votes were engineered to have President Joe Biden win in 2020. The county devoted nearly an entire May meeting to election deniers that featured David Clements, a former assistant professor at New Mexico State University who travels the country preaching about fraud. Clements, who lost his university job last year because he refused to wear a mask in class, urged Surrey to hand count ballots. At the meeting's end, Surrey Board Chairman Bill Goines told the crowd that commissioners were reviewing residents' recommendations, but concerns about fraud should go to the local and state boards of elections. Someone in the crowd yelled, "Pontius Pilate!" Goines could not be reached by telephone this week. The State Board of Elections runs a feature on its website and social media accounts called Mythbuster Mondays that took on that question about electronic tampering back in April. The Mythbuster answer, North Carolina voting equipment does not contain modem chips, and state law prohibits voting machines from being connected wirelessly to any other device. That didn't end the rumors. David Diamond, a former State House member from Surrey, said the search for election fraud reflects a deep distrust in government, saying they just don't trust government anymore. It's a disease. It's scary. It's so different from when it was when I was in politics. Most North Carolina voters mark paper ballots that are fed into tabulators. With former President Donald Trump's lies about widespread voter fraud came assertions of tabulator tampering via internet connections. These beliefs have taken hold even in places like Surrey, where Trump won 75% of the vote. Dominion Voting Systems is suing former Trump lawyer Sidney Powell for her wild claims about its machines. In a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, Powell's lawyers wrote last year, quote, "No reasonable person would conclude that the statements were true statements of fact." Let me read that again. Powell's lawyers wrote, "No reasonable person would conclude that the statements were truly statements of fact." No North Carolina county uses Dominion equipment, yet Republicans have demanded to look inside the machines that get deployed to voting sites to search for modems or chips. In the counties, demands to scrap machines for hand counting are intersecting with the distrust of voting equipment. Surrey County GOP Chairman Keith Sentner told Surrey Elections Director she would lose her job or have her pay cut after she refused demands for access to voting equipment, reported Reuters. Center didn't return phone calls this week, but he's a regular at open forum portions of commissioners' meetings. Were the machines in Surrey County connected to the internet, or do they have cell or internet capability? He asked in April, invoking the names of nationally known election deniers, including Trump backer MyPillow guy Mike Lindell. The only way you will know is to do a forensic analysis of the machines. Center's appearances at commissioners' meetings to rail about elections continued through the summer. Among the pages on the State Board of Elections website about cybersecurity, election security, and misinformation is a page on voting machine security that attempts to knock down rumors about modem-embedded machines. It includes a statement from Trump himself, released ahead of a trip to North Carolina last summer, praising his victory in the state, quote, "without a fraudulent outcome." Election deniers have champions in the state legislators, in the state legislature. Members of the far-right Freedom Caucus in the North Carolina House announced at a press conference last October they intended to inspect Durham County voting machines for devices that would enable internet connections. That investigation didn't happen after the State Board of Elections director said unauthorized people can't have access to voting machines. In the lead-up to October, correspondence between the office of Representative Keith Kidwell, Republican 79th District, chairman of the Freedom Caucus, and the Board of Elections in the summer of 2021 shows that caucus members had been trying to find a way to open active machines months before they were announced they were going into Durham. Elections Board staff had been meeting with caucus members about election processes and trying to convince them that none of the machines used in North Carolina can access the Internet. Elections Board spokesman Patrick Gannon told Kidwell on a June 8th email in answer to a question, that's June 8th last year, in a question about modems, there are no mechanisms in place to send or receive data to or from any modem on certified voting equipment, and state law prohibits any county from using a modem connection in voting equipment. A trusted elections tour that plans to stop in each of the state's 14 congressional districts devotes time in each 90-minute town hall for an explanation on how voting machines work. In addition to computer experts, the meetings feature county election directors, Democratic and Republican elections lawyers, and Democrat and Republican members of county elections board. The Carter Center, a nonprofit based in Atlanta, is sponsoring the tour. Bob Orr, a former Republican North Carolina Supreme Court Justice, and former Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts are leading the effort. At the Johnston County Courthouse on August 31st, Brad Reeves, an expert in computer system privacy at NC State, told the audience that none of the state's voting machines can be hacked because they're never connected to a network. Mitch Kokai, senior political analyst at the John Locke Foundation, moderated the session and asked panelists questions the audience submitted. The local elections officials got the challenging ones. Among the questions, why can't a community hand count if that's what the community wants to do? Johnston County Elections Board Chairman Gordon Woodruff said there are far too many ballots to count by hand. About 110,000 people voted in Johnston County in 2020. Recent recounts have found errors of one or two votes, representing a tiny fraction of 1%, he said, and the hand-eye audits that the state requires for selected precincts confirm the machine's accuracy, he said. The machines are so good, he said, it's really not a major issue. Nevertheless, interest in hand counting is taking root. It's become a theme for the half dozen or so people who regularly attended Surrey Commissioner meetings this summer to complain about elections. One resident told the commissioners that school children should be given the task of counting ballots as part of civics instruction starting in the sixth grade. In an interview this week, Orr said elections officials have appreciated the chance to talk about what they do. Participants aren't there to challenge people's beliefs, he said, but to let audiences hear from the local people who run elections about how it all works. Some of the same questions get asked at every stop, Orr said. He thinks members of groups challenging the elections go to the town halls to raise them. The only real vocal pushback so far came in New Bern, where a video substituted for a live election security expert. People in the audience called it propaganda and lies, Orr said. It's a lack of information or understanding or confidence in technology, Orr said. I don't know what you do about that, but we're trying. And next, a cover story from Indy Week from the Food and Drink Department, Food Waste Feast. Gabby Mindig writes this. Margaret and Irene Lee are on a mission to reduce food waste, and they're bringing eaters along for the ride. The sisters are the co-founders of the project Food Waste Feast, a website, blog, and educational resource that has found a cult following around the country and between Margaret's home base in Cary and Irene's home base in Boston. In 2012, Margaret, who goes by May, and Irene, alongside their older brother, founded May May, a food truck in Boston. In 2013, the business expanded to a brick-and-mortar restaurant and then, during the pandemic, evolved into a dumpling company. Mimi means little sister in Mandarin. May explains, the nickname for me came about as a child when I was the little sister in the family. When my older brother came up with the idea for the food truck, he asked my sister Irene and I to join him, and we thought the name May May was a great way to honor the family vibe behind the business. It was at Maymay, while producing food on a large scale, that the Lees began to notice the vast amount of food waste generated in restaurant operations. Waste that made already slim restaurant margins even slimmer. Equipped with an MBA from University College London, May brought a business-minded perspective to the family endeavor. She says, the things you're purchasing and spending tons of money on, if that's going to the trash, you are wasting your money. At Maymay, the Lee's solution to the challenge of food waste is to become more open-minded and creative with the menu items and recipes. May explains, one of the things that we did at our food truck and restaurant was try to design dishes that used up all parts of an ingredient, whether it's kale with holes in it that would go into our pesto, or using cilantro stems in curry. It really helped our bottom line and also made for more interesting and delicious dishes. The frustration of waste and the excitement and joy that grew out of addressing that frustration is what sparked Food Waste Feast. The sisters hit a chord. The website has been so successful, it will be the foundation of a cookbook, slated for release in June of next year. May says there are lots of things that feel very big and unchangeable. Contributing to minimizing your food waste is something that we can do. And it's not our sole responsibility, but it feels good to do that for me. And I hope for other people, too. Research has shown that individuals are more likely to take incremental, tangible steps that have a real impact and allow them the satisfaction of knowing that their personal actions make a difference. In the food production system, there are a multitude of points at which food waste can occur. And on a grand scale, it does at each and every point, from farm to distributor to market to refrigerator, refrigerator to trash can. Much of that food never even makes it to a plate, let alone a stomach. According to the United States Department of Agriculture, between 30 and 40% of the food supply in the United States is wasted. I'll just read that again. Between 30 and 40% of the food supply in the United States is wasted. There are many factors at play, and even for the most environmentally conscious among us, May says, the fate of climate change doesn't rest on whether you put your carrot tops into the compost. Still, the actions of individuals do matter, as about 32% of food brought into household goes to waste. There are many angles from which to engage people's consciousness about food waste and find practical, sometimes creative ways to address the problem. One approach that grabs individual attention and interest is the impact on their own finances. The Lees were initially attuned to the cost of food waste in their commercial kitchen at Maymay, but even within homes, individuals are estimated to spend thousands of dollars a year on food they end up throwing out. With the rising cost of food due to inflation and other factors, that financial burden only grows. Home cooks who are interested in trying something new might find that the challenging of minimizing food waste presents exciting opportunities for experimentation in the kitchen. This is where Food Waste Feast comes in, with the Lees guiding and educating readers through a multitude of creative ways to cut down on kitchen waste. May, who recently turned 40 and moved to Kerry with her husband and two kids in 2019, says, there are people who just really like it from a cooking perspective. Let's say you've got fresh herbs and you're making a herb oil or a herb sauce, or you're taking your leftover bread and making breadcrumbs. You have more components to work with. She describes another approach that individual consumers might take, a technique not only for convincing her kids to eat their fruits and veggies, but also for continuously transforming leftovers so that nothing ends up in the trash. She says, if they don't eat all their apple slices, I'll put them in a bag, and that becomes their smoothie bag. I'll keep it in the freezer, then I'll make it into smoothies. And if they don't drink those smoothies, I make it into popsicles, and then I feed it to them again. I try to reincarnate things as much as possible. When asked if there is any effort to reduce waste that goes over the top, Mayer shares, well, it all depends on what you think is weird. I'll sometimes think my mom is going too far. I'm like, you don't need all those takeout sauces. Then she'll put together a chicken marinade from all her different takeout sauces, and I'm like, okay, and that was really good. A tremendous amount of natural resources and energy are expended in all aspects of food production. So for those who are passionate about fighting climate change, minimizing food waste plays an important role. Food production and transportation systems generate carbon dioxide, and when food is disposed of and enters landfills, it releases methane, a potent greenhouse gas that causes pollution and affects the climate detrimentally. According to the USDA, food waste makes up 24% of materials found in landfills, more than any other substance. With all those impacts and perspectives in mind, Food Waste Feast's next venture, their cookbook, titled Perfectly Good Food, will take shape with a new approach to recipes. May says, in writing our cookbook, thinking about the way that recipes are often written, you realize how it can be very limiting. She explains that shopping for and cooking recipes with long, specific ingredient lists means that home cooks often end up with leftover ingredients that sit on a shelf and expire, or that they don't know how to use up in another way. Perfectly good food recipes are more expansive. A recipe may call for 2 cups of chopped root vegetables rather than golden beets. One of the book's philosophies is to think about ingredients in categories like grains and leafy greens. Ingredients within those categories can often be swapped for similar results, and that adaptability can help reduce waste and often make for more tasty, flexible, and personalized dishes. May says, it may not be exactly the way it looks in that beautiful magazine cover, but it's going to taste perfectly good. Boy, folks, I'm taking this article home with me. I just threw out a cantaloupe today. Well, I'm offered about 5-6 minutes left. And food and drink, again, a review or introduction to Pierre Togo, which is on Anger Avenue in Durham. The Triangle's first Haitian restaurant. Lena Geller writes, I've never really had the desire to eat styrofoam, but last week, staring down at an empty, marinade-drenched to-go box, I faced an existential question. What would be harder to stomach, consuming this flavorful foam wholesale or letting all the marinade go to waste? The marinade, a traditional Haitian seasoning base called épice, that blends fresh herbs, vegetables, olive oil, and citrus juice, is the backbone of nearly every dish at Pierre Togo, a Haitian eatery in East Durham that launched in early 2019 and, due to pandemic challenges, shuttered for more than 2 years before reopening 2 weeks ago. As far as Haitian cuisine goes, épi is paramount, but like any good marinade, the mixture can only work half the magic on its own. The other half, of course, comes from time. Most dishes at Pierre Togo require at least a day of preparation. Every meat on the menu, chicken, pork, red snapper, is marinated in épi for at least 24 hours before it hits the pan. And side items get a similar treatment. Picles, a pickled vegetable relish, steeps in a spicy vinegar brew for weeks before portioned into ramekins and served alongside griot, a classic deep-fried pork shoulder entree. Though most dishes share the same seasoning, the menu is far from monotonous, with épi acting as an aromatic grout for a complex mosaic of tastes and textures. Owner Jethro Pierre learned the importance of marination from his childhood nanny, a Haitian woman who cooked him food while his parents were at work. One day I saw her pouring marinade over meat and she put it in the fridge. I was like, I'm hungry right now. And she's like, oh no, that's for the next few days. Then, like in a televised cooking show, she pulled out a tray of meat that had marinated overnight. A child of two Haitian immigrants, Pierre spent his early years in Toronto and moved to Orlando, Florida. As a young teen, he dreamed of becoming an FBI agent, but his parents didn't approve of this career path, he says. Instead, hoping to set him on a different track, his mother pulled him out of school one day and surprised him with a visit to a nearby culinary arts school. Pierre says, within that first hour, I fell in love with the smell, the clacking of the pans on the fire, the gas. It just ignited something in me. After graduating from college, Pierre spent nearly two decades climbing the restaurant industry food chain, working as a dishwasher at Wendy's, a prep cook at Disney World, before landing an executive chef job at the global hospitality company Aramark. In 2016, seeking a change of pace after losing his parents and undergoing a painful divorce, Pierre moved to Raleigh and launched his own catering service while working a remote job as a French translator to pay the bills. A few years later, he met Joe Bushfan, a celebrity bodyguard turned Durham hot dog vendor who had recently closed his East Durham diner and converted it into a rentable commercial kitchen called Joe's Commissary. Bushfan, who tells me he was drawn to Pierre's ability to open up people's palates, minds, and hearts through Haitian cuisine, decided to make Pierre an offer. If Pierre moved his catering operation to Joe's Commissary, Bushfan would allow him to open his own restaurant in the facility's overflow room. He had some reservations about working in Durham. He'd only ever heard negative things about the city, he says, but after Bushfan explained the history and trajectory of East Durham and the area's need for vibrant, community-oriented businesses, Pierre was sold. When Pierre Thigault held its grand opening in April 2019, marking the launch of the first Haitian restaurant in the Triangle, Pierrot knew he'd picked a good location. I said, there's no way this is the same Durham I've heard about. I'm talking about diversity, college students, police officer, people from the neighborhood. We had over 100 Haitians that came from all over. I was so shocked about the capacity of love that was shown. Right there. That's where I fell in love with Durham. Well, I can hear our musical interpreters sneaking around corners, hoping that I'll pop out of my door before they disappear. But I think I'll wait them out by hiding in my desk drawer. Now, that's all the time I have for reading the Indie Week to you this week. John Feddersen for the Indie Week and IndieWeek.com. It's available as a podcast, of course, right on our website, which is ncreadingservice.org. Thanks for listening to this broadcast, everybody. Have a good week.